listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Each week, I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, Melanie and I will be sharing a little bit about ourselves and what we do to help families turn their lives right side up. Now, here at the show and at my office, we get a lot of calls from families looking for help in handling their teenager. Just last week, I had a mother who said, "Please help. I feel like my life is turned upside down." So that sort of gave us the idea that, you know, we really wanted to talk a little bit about what we do and maybe even a little bit about what we don't do. Because, again, many of these families have called. I've talked with quite a few parents. And in some cases, they call and they go, "Please, quick, come pick up my child." And I go, "Okay, what do you want us to do?" They go, "Well, I want you to take them to one of those programs." I go, "Which one?" They go, "I don't care. Just take them to one of the programs." So I thought, you know, that's probably a good way for us to go on the air and talk about the fact that that isn't what we do. We don't make those choices all the time. So that's kind of how we got to the topic for this particular show. Now, once again, my co-host, and in this case, also the guest today, is Dr. Melanie Fox. Melody is a licensed clinical psychologist and a marriage and family therapist who has spent the last 15 years working with families and specializing in working with teens, both living in at-risk situations and those who just need a little extra support. Most recently, Dr. Fox was the director of a school-based adolescent mental health program, both working directly with teens, teachers, and parents, as well as advising and training interns from the Marriage and Family Therapist Master's programs at USC and SCU Dominguez Hills. Melody currently has a private practice in Newport Beach, California, working with both teens and adults from throughout the Orange County area. Melody, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be back.
Well, I really like the idea. In fact, we need to give Jan the credit for really talking about, you know, or telling us that what we need to talk about is a little bit more about what we do. And again, as I said, what we don't do. So I think to start off, I mean, let's kind of go a little bit more into your background, what it is that you were doing and what got you to this place.
Okay, shoot.
Okay, well, let me share what some of the people may not know, because I mean, I know that you had a very successful career in radio here locally in Los Angeles. What made you decide to leave and get into the therapy field?
Well, I never in a million years would have thought I was going to be a therapist. However, I had the inklings of it. I remember back in high school, I had an advice column called Ask Amber. I had a friend named Amber. I went to another school, liked the name, didn't want anybody to know it was me. So for the school newspaper, I was answering questions like, "Oh, my teacher hates me, what do I need to do?" Or, "My parents are mad," or "My best friend," or whatever. So I give them my advice. I've always had friends come up to me and ask me a bunch of questions on how to deal with things, and I tend to analyze everything, or I used to now. I try not to do that anymore, unless I have to. But I spent a lot of time helping other people. I fell into radio years and years ago. In fact, I was at a high school, and they had a high school radio station, and the teacher said I was really good at it, I should consider it. And I thought, well, I have one thing I'm good at, I should consider it. So I fell into that, did that for about 16 years. But during that time, I spent a lot of time ending up in doing requests and dedications. One of the shows I had was, "If you're crying, loving, or leaving somebody, give me a call, we'll talk about it, I'll give you my opinion, I'll play a song for you, and life is good."
So let me see if I got this right. The topic of the show was crying, loving, or leaving?
Yes.
Yeah, I would think you'd get some people calling that maybe are dealing with some struggles.
Right, exactly. And one of the things I got tired of hearing about was people were staying in these horrible relationships, being treated horribly and very disrespectfully, and being cheated on, et cetera. And And they stayed in these relationships for the simple quote, in quotations here, because I love her, because I love him. And I got really tired of hearing that people were staying in relationships because they love them. It's like, don't you love yourself?
Exactly.
You know, you need to learn to take care of yourself. You deserve to be treated better than that. You're worth more than that. So along with that, and then being in radio, a lot of times late at night, you get a lot of people that are suicidal that call up. You get a lot of lonely people and a lot of shut-ins that come in, and you get those calls. I remember one time I got into trouble because I did not say the call letters. I just played a couple songs, too many in a row, but I was on the phone with someone who was suicidal, and at that point, a light went off in my head and said, you know, people are more important than call letters. I really, really need to figure out how I could help people more than just play a song for them and talk to them on the phone for a few moments. So I had an opportunity to go back to school. I did that. And one thing led to another, and here I am.
Right. Well, now what you said is this, so you had someone call in to you while you were working for a radio station, and although your job was as a disc jockey to mm-hmm. be putting on records,
sure.
they felt comfortable enough with you to start talking about their own suicidal tendencies or their own mm-hmm. suicidal issues.
Exactly. There's a lot of lonely people and a lot of people that don't get out or are very comfortable interacting with other people. And I think when you're doing radio right, you're talking to the person listening. You aren't talking to somebody else and somebody happens to be eavesdropping, but they really feel like you're talking to them. And because that's what you want to make. You want to make a connection with the people that are listening, and that's really important. And I think that translates over really nicely with working with people in the office and kids that are in crisis or families or adults, is you want to be able to connect with them and really listen to what they have to say and be able to be empathetic and help support them.
Well, that's probably why they called you and not Dr. Laura.
Well, we'll be nice here.
I know. So once you decided to make this switch, I mean, we're talking about going back to school. I mean, it sounds like this is starting a whole new career or going back to square one.
It basically was going back to square one, giving up absolutely everything and life as I knew it. No more, you know, parties and going out to DJ and host things or doing commercials, etc. It was basically back to school. I had to go back and finish my AA, my bachelor's, my master's to become a marriage family therapist. One of the first jobs I had was working at a psychiatric hospital. And when I found out to do the work I really wanted to do, they said I need to become a doctor. And I thought, okay, fine, I'll become a doctor then. So I gave up all my internship hours as a marriage family therapist at the time, and I went back and got my doctorate in clinical psychology and was working on those hours. And during that time, I wasn't really thinking about children or teens or anything. My focus were the elderly, the mm-hmm. geriatric population. I've always really enjoyed being around older people, and you learn so much from older people if you just listen to them. Yep. And also, I like the idea of helping them transition into old age and be okay with it, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to deal with changes in their physical abilities through strokes or accidents or Alzheimer's or dealing with their loved one that has dementia or what have you. And that was really fascinating to me. But during this period of time, I realized, you know, I need to make a little bit more money than as a psych assistant. So I took a job working in group homes, and I had to renew all my marriage family therapy hours, and I started off on those hours again and eventually got those completed. So I have both licenses, and I'm very proud of that and very excited about that because it allows me to work in a variety of areas and a lot of different areas that I
well,
like.
Now, what was some of your early experiences as far as working with adolescents?
Well, with adolescents, I found that girls, just like growing up in high school, as I knew, and most women do know, that girls like drama. They don't like to let go of anything. They never forget. And I'm sure guys know that as well. And guys are a lot of fun. I enjoy working with the boys because they're so in the moment. You know, they could be in a fist fight 1 minute, and they'll be shooting baskets 10 minutes later with the same guys they were just fighting with. So, you know, very different populations, and they're so interesting. Every human being is different, and every human being comes to the world and has a different way of surviving. And I've always been interested in how do people get from point A to point B, from early childhood to old age? How do they navigate that, and how do they get there, and how do they survive? Some people grow up in the same household, and one goes down one path doing drugs, alcohol, et cetera, and the other one is a CEO of a company and highly successful, or what social media and everybody says is successful. So, you know, everybody is different, and people fascinate me, and I think that's what drew me to this career.
Well, and one of the things that I noticed and when I first met you was, I mean, I really saw that you really enjoyed, when we started talking about teens, and you lit up, and I thought, okay, this is somebody who really enjoys working with this population. What is your passion, or what drives that passion for you?
I think what drives the passion for me is working with teens are they are in such flux in their lives. There is so much going on, not only developmentally, about trying to figure out who they are, testing limits, trying to be a woman or a man when they're still a child, and trying to navigate that and getting their independence, but still having the protection of the parents and feeling safe enough to go try new things and fail and go forward. And what I found are a lot of children don't have the support to become adults, and they need that little extra support to find out what their core strengths are, what their passions are, what they're good at. Like that teacher helped me years and years ago at the radio station at the high school, told me I was good at something. I never would have thought that. Who would have guessed? But I tried that, and it was just one person telling me something I was good at and helping me to find that. That gave me a wonderful career for 16 years. So that was fabulous. So what I'd like to do is be able to give back and help other teens find that one core passion of theirs that they're good at and that they enjoy, and then help them figure out how to make that happen and create the life they want, whether they're in the ideal family or not the ideal family.
Well, which is a great point. Now, let's talk about when they're not in the ideal family. In many situations, you know, those are the types of calls that you get or that we get. And when you get that, how do you handle that part? Because I know that oftentimes when I'm talking with a parent, one of the first things that I have to deal with is the guilt that they have over the fact that they even have to call. And if you can't get over that, I would think they're not going to come in. So how do you handle that?
About them not coming in, the parents coming
in?
In
other words, the parents, but you know, bringing in the whole family. In other words, when you have the parent that calls, but you can sense in them a sense of guilt that they have to even call. In other words, so what can you do to help, number one, make that parent make the right decision to come in as a family and start working on those issues? And then how do you transfer some of the things that you've just talked about, those things to where you're going to teach that child how to feel good about themselves? In other words, can we get the parents to be the one to now start telling them, look, you need to be the one that's reinforcing with this child that they're good at something, and then help take them there?
Well, I don't really see the resistance from the parents and the guilt about bringing them in for services.
Oh, good.
A lot of times, by the time they get to the point where they contact me, their hands are up in the air, and they don't know what to do, and they'll take whatever help they could get, wherever they could get it. What I do find are there are different kinds of families. I know one of the topics we're going to talk about is upside-down families, how to write them up, and maybe I could talk about that for a minute because it addresses some of what you asked about.
Absolutely.
Because there's some families that come in that aren't functioning well as a family as a whole, and they want to learn new ways or get new tools to help them function right side up. And those families are great to work with because I could teach them better communication skills, parenting skills, behavior modification, cognitive behavioral techniques, which is also called CBT. If you ever watch Nanny 911, she uses a lot of behavioral modification and cognitive behavioral techniques, and they do work if you work them. And if you have a family that is motivated to do that, you know, it works really well in creating a right side up family.
Well, why don't you give our listeners a couple of examples?
A couple of examples may be, you know, you have a teenager that doesn't want to come in at their 10 o'clock curfew because the party's just getting started at 10 o'clock. But you instead of just waiting till they walk in the door and going off on them and punishing them, taking away their iPod for 10 million years, which you know you're not really going to do anyway. Mm-hmm. They'll get it back within a couple of weeks, if that. They would, you know, you would tell ahead of time, you give a child a choice. It's like, you come in at 10 o'clock on time, everything's good. You choose to come in past your curfew time, then these are the consequences that are going to happen. You're going to lose your iPod for 2 weeks. You're not going to have phone contact for the weekend. And no, you don't get to go skiing next weekend. Sorry. Right. That's your decision. So if the party's worth coming in late and losing those, you know, extra things, fine. But you give the power to the child to decide. That's where they start learning to think. Is this worth the consequence or not? And then you are consistent with it. If they know that you're going to give them back their iPod the next day, it's not going to mean anything to them. They'll just keep pushing the limits. So you set the limit. They make the choice. They choose not to follow your rules and come in at the curfew time. Then you follow through and take away what you said you were going to take away.
Now, do you put this? Do you have them put this in writing so that there is no miscommunication of, well, I thought that meant something else?
I've never thought about putting in writing, you know, a contract. Usually it's more verbal, but you can mm-hmm. put the rules up on a board or something if you'd like to do, and that's especially helpful for the younger children to, you know, take out the trash by 6 p.m. or no dessert tonight.
Right, and it's on the board choice. In case you somehow misunderstood what that meant.
Exactly, but those kind of families that really want to use those techniques and really are motivated to learn, you know, it really helped them learn to function as a healthy family that is right side up. And those motivated families do want to change for the better. They do the work and they follow through. But then I have families who want to come in and they think they want to change, but they really have no motivation. And it's usually very unconscious about not wanting to change. They're the ones who may complain about the dysfunction, their family and all the arguing and fighting, but they really, in some level, really don't want anything to change. It serves a purpose for them. They like the chaos. Maybe that's what they grew up with and they're used to it. And to disrupt their status quo is not what needs to be done. The dysfunction works for them.
Now, is that happen in many cases where one of the person, you know, involved is a saboteur? In other words, they're acting like they're getting on board, but yet you're saying that one that really doesn't want it to change may be the same one that's sabotaging the growth?
Right. Sometimes that does happen. And if I can identify that person who's the most resistant to the change, who does the sabotaging, I'll either work with them individually instead of working with the family, or if I'm working with the family, because I don't really want a dual relationship there, is I'll refer them out to another therapist to do their own individual work on their own and then bring those changes back to the family. As you said, people sabotage any efforts for change of other family members. And other times, I just leave it alone because if it works for them, the family as a whole, then, and there's no abuse or neglect going on, then so be it. It works for them. It's like seeing a couple who argues all the time. I wouldn't want that life. That's not what I want at home when I come home to argue all the time. But you know, some families, that's just the way they are, and they enjoy it, and it works for them.
Well, okay, now, in thinking about the sabotage part, and there's actually something that I do, and I want to bounce it off of you and see what you think of this. But when the call comes in and they say that, okay, you know, we're referring this case to you because they want Johnny to go to a specialized program, and we've been trying to do this for the last 6 months, but one of the parents, sometimes mom, sometimes dad, continues to sabotage it. So now psychologically you're saying, okay, that's probably the person that really doesn't want the change.
That could be so, but in what way are they sabotaging it? Because that makes a difference as well.
Well, and it could be that, you know, at the last minute they tell the child that somebody's coming to get them the next morning so that they're not there because they really don't want the child gone. Somehow, as you're saying, being in the home, either there's a guilt, and I don't know, and I guess I should ask you, I don't know if the saboteur is doing it because there's a guilt and they're concerned because of something they did wrong, that the child shouldn't have to get sent away, or they just can't even imagine the child being sent away.
Right, and that's where you identify who that person is that's doing the sabotaging and working with them on what's really going on with them, what is their connection, what is their resistance in their child getting the best support and help possible. and they may have their own issues going on that you want to help them work through. And I think that's really important because that'll benefit everybody in the whole. And if you get them to understand, well, that's great. Here's some referrals to go work with somebody, work on these issues while your child's working on their issues. Well, let's all come back together and you could have a healthier, happier family that communicates better, respects each other a little bit more, and functions as a whole better. But, you know, it's like not saying a bad apple, but one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. Yeah, according to the song.
You could write a song. That's right.
I think it's been done.
I'm trying to think. Was that Michael Jackson or Donny Osmond? I don't
remember. You know, that's a good question. I believe it was, you know what? I don't know. I listened to both as a child.
It was one of those two. Yeah, we're in about the same era.
Yeah.
Let me share with you kind of what I have done and kind of critique it, because what you're saying is you're taking them aside and you're kind of working with them separately. I have actually told admissions people, put me on the phone, tell me ahead of time how they're sabotaging. Tell me what, you know, if there's the last four times something has come up and you've identified that one person is doing this, tell me what they're doing and then put me on the phone the next time. But I want to make sure that both the parents are on the phone. And then at that time, I expose them and I shine a light on them, but not to where I could possibly know what I was doing. So in other words, I would do it from the standpoint of, I would get them to the point of saying, okay, well, you know, can you tell me, I mean, how successful are these programs really? I mean, if you've really been around for 30 years, you should have an idea. And I go, that's a great question. And let me tell you that with the exception of when a parent sabotages, I spoke to 600 past clients some years ago, and I had an overwhelming amount of success stories. I had very, very few people. Out of 600 people, I had two people that said that they felt that the system failed them or that the program did. So I tell them, I go, so you have no reason, nothing to worry about. The program has a great reputation. Everything's going to go great unless one of these, and I name off four or five ways in which people sabotage. I go, unless one of the parents does one of these, and then there's a high rate of them not succeeding because the parent has caused that to happen. Now, by shining a light on it, but not attacking them,
sure,
but I'm shining a light on it, I'm thinking that the chances are they're not going to be able to now use that same tactic because a saboteur doesn't like to shine a light on themselves.
Sure.
So let me ask you, what do you think of this as a alternative tactic?
I think it's a great tactic to use because you're not singling anybody out, but that's the difference between if they're coming to me for therapy and trying to help their child and you're working on helping them transport their child to a facility to get the help they need, because we play a little bit different roles. But I might utilize that too, because maybe part of the fear and the sabotaging has to do with their fear, is this program really going to work for my child? And I don't want to send them away if it's not going to work. So if you can answer the questions, yeah, I've talked to 600 people. Only two said they didn't think it worked for them, but 598 thought it was a great program. They would do it again in a heartbeat. They wish they would have done it, you know, 2 years earlier, you know, what have you. So to ease some of the fears.
Right. And you bring up a great point, because if we can do that to deal with the short-term issue that is their child, but if they're having some form of home care or aftercare, you know, where somebody like yourself locally is working with the family, that's going to be huge if you can start working with them and deal with that so that when the child comes back, they don't fall back into that same pattern of sabotaging the growth of that child.
Well, and that's a lot when we've talked to other people in the past that have different programs throughout the country, is how do they work with the parents? How do they get the child back in? And all of them have said the same thing. The parents need to continue to do the work. They need to continue learning the tools they need to support their child and help them function in the best possible way possible. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the families who have someone acting out the dysfunction in the family, and they become the identified patient, the scapegoat, you know, if you will, that it's the family who have identified a problem person, and I don't think any person's a problem. I think behaviors are a problem, but
right.
But they blame that one particular person for all the discord in the family. And this is where teaching the family that they all play a part in that discord and teach them new and better ways of getting their needs met so that they are taking responsibility for their own individual part in the family. And those are the families that really want to help the identified person and learn to work as a whole. But then the last area I have is we have an identified person, and it's usually the teens, because the teens are going through their natural maturation process. Mm-hmm. They are learning to become individuals and a little bit rebellious maybe at sometimes, but that's all part of the normal developmental process, depending on the degree of it. However, at times the teens are the identified person causing all the problems in the families. And these are the teens I really like to work with the most, because these are the teens that come from a family that's totally upside down. They don't know what they're going to do. The family is not going to change no matter what. And that's what works for the family, but it doesn't work for the teens. And I often find that the teens will come in, and after assessing the teen, I realize that they are the only person that is sane. They are right side up. You know, they've got it together. They're the most insightful. They're the most empathetic, and they're the least crazy person I've ever met in their life. And they've got the numbers of their parents. They understand mm-hmm. that they're crazy. But, you know, these are maybe the teens that are fighting more with their parents. Their grades are getting lower. Some are depressed. They may come in because, whether they realize it or not, that their parents are really screwed up and not going to change, and they have to mourn the loss of their parents. Their parents are not going to be the kind of parent that they want or they need or they desire. They're not going to be their best friend's parents.
Right.
Which, you know, the grass seems to always be greener, but they're not having the parents they wish they had. So the job is to help them to accept their parents for who they are and know that their parents, for better or for worse, are doing the best job at parenting that they know how to do. Because most parents do. Mm-hmm. I've worked with a lot of kids in foster care, and parents have ridden the bus for 3 hours to come visit the child for 1 hour and do parenting classes and go through all that work. They're just doing the best they can with what they know how to do. And then you've got the very little percentage of the parents that really are off on another zone, another life, that really just have no connection whatsoever. But most parents are just doing the best and really want the best for their kids. So in the meantime, you know, I try to help them find out what kind of life, what kind of relationships, what future goals that these teens want for themselves, and work towards creating that for themselves, whether they could do that here, now, in the present, in the family that they're currently in, or they may have to wait until they're 18 and they're out on their own to create the life they want. And we could work for, you know, helping them become less depressed, become more productive, and find a happier way to live and survive in their upside down family, because some families are just not going to change. If that makes sense.
It certainly does. She is Dr. Melody Fox. I am Alan Cardoza. You are listening to Answers for the Family. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking about turning families right side up.
And we're also talking about each other to find out a little bit more about us, so people feel a little bit more comfortable about what we're talking about and as we interview other people. But right now, the listeners know a little bit more about me, probably more than they want to know at the moment. But I think they need to know a little bit more about you. I know Alan Cardoza, you are a licensed private investigator, a certified instructor in nonviolent crisis intervention with over 30 years experience working with families in crisis. And I've learned that you have escorted literally thousands of teens to specialized schools and programs, returned hundreds of runaways, and retrieve many abducted children, some from countries most people wouldn't even think about visiting, much less bring an abducted or traffic a child out of. And I think this is going to be fun and very informative and interesting because it's such a vast array of things that you do, and it's so important. And most people don't even understand that this is going on or your services are even available to help them with their child, especially a runaway child. But why don't you first start off on telling me a little bit about you? Are you married, single? I've heard you say you've got the best woman in the world.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I have one of the most spiritually and physically beautiful women in my life that I'm very happy with. I have two great boys. They are so different and yet wonderful in their own right. I'm blessed with a beautiful and bright bonus daughter. So, I really do feel blessed. And from a business standpoint, I think one of the blessings that I have is the fact that I have been I've been able to do jobs where I can make a difference in people's lives, I can help other people, and I can still make a living at it. You know, so I mean, it's great to be able to do something that you love. That part's good, but to really feel like that I'm making a difference in the lives of others, that's huge. And that's sort of been my goal and my belief system probably since the time in which I got in this business.
And how long ago was it that you got into this business, and how did you get into this business? It's such a unique niche that you have of what you do.
Well, it's now 30 years. It must be over 30 years by now. I always have to do my own age and then work backwards from that. But it's been over 30 years. And really, I started out, I was working for a very, very bright private investigator who assigned me to a certain account for a local hospital. And he said, his words were, I think I'm going to have you start locating these runaways that take off from this hospital because you look like them.
And, so you were really young then.
I was 19 and I looked like I was about 15, or at least I could pass for 15. Of course, when you're 19, you don't want to look like you're 15. You want to look like you're over 21. And then obviously when you get a little older, you like the fact that you can look younger. But anyway, he sent me out to do this, and it was something that was a natural. I felt, that the investigative training he had taught me helped me to be able to locate them. But that was only the first step. That was a very small step in this whole process, because then I started talking to them to find out, why are you in this situation? You know, when I'm finding them in, you know, four or five kids in one flea bag hotel, all doing a huge amount of drugs, and when I go in there, you know, half of which aren't even able to get up off the ground, and I'm having to pick out the one that I'm supposed to pick up and take back to a psychiatric facility or to a drug rehab program.
Don't you feel like you want to take them all with you?
I do. In fact, actually, there's stories that go with that too, where there's been times in which I've asked the other ones, you know, I've said, you know, look, I don't have paperwork that says that I can make you go with me, but I'd like you to sign this little thing saying that you want to go with me, because I can get you help. I can get you a meal, or I can get you better, a better roof over your head or something. So yes, I have done that. I've even done it when picking up runaways, where I've picked them up off the street, and I didn't want to leave one by the roadside. You know, I'm taking this one with me, but I'll take you home. I'll take you where I'm going to a program. I'll take you where, you know, pretty much wherever it is you want to go. But understand that if you do choose to go with me, it's not going to be to take you to a drug dealer. It's not going to be to drop you off at, you know, in front of a liquor store. I'm going to contact your parents, and we're going to do something that's proactive.
And be in a safe place.
Absolutely. And believe it or not, in many cases, they just say, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
I think that's great. But earlier I mentioned that you do nonviolent crisis intervention. Can you explain what that is?
Well, it's a training. I became a certified instructor, and I was looking at different programs of trainings that I could do to help work with the kids. I remember when I first got started that I would start working cases, and when I would get out to a program, so there would be an admissions person that recommended me. So, but when I got there and they actually saw me for the first time, they would stumble a little bit over their words and go, "Hi, it's really good to meet you. You're not what I expected." And in the back of my mind, I thought, "Well, you mean because my knuckles don't drag on the ground?" Because the vision back then, and we're talking about, the late 70s, early 80s, the vision at that time was that they assumed that it was a very large, strong, muscular person that was just scooping them up off the street and taking them off to the program. And I was anything but that. That I was enjoying the fact that I would find these kids and I would sit down and I would talk to them and I would, "What's going on with you? What's going on that I might be able to help?" And understand, we're still going back to the program, but I'm going to do everything that I can to help. And I think that the relationship that I established with them put me in a position to where the program started looking at it saying, "Would you be interested in just start picking up from home? They don't even have to be a runaway. We'd like you to pick them up from home." And they started telling me horror stories of parents that in getting their child in were deceiving them so much. And there was everything from, and I had heard a story where parents that were coming from another state had put their child in a motorhome and duct taped them to the chair so that they couldn't get out of the motorhome.
You're shaking my head.
Yeah, I know. I should tell everybody because I'm looking across the studio at this, and Melody's just shaking her head going, "You've got to be kidding." That's the look in her eyes is like, "I cannot believe this." But
well,
seriously.
Well, I can believe it.
Yeah.
I've worked with abused and neglected
right.
children and people that have been fed up, and they do what they think they have to do.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not always in the best interest of the child.
Right. And I realize, at that parent is probably believing that that's the only choice they have. But I think that what sort of was the evolution of the adolescent transport industry was the fact that they realized that if there was somebody that was young and that could relate to them and that was honest with them, and that's one of the things that is driven into the minds of every one of our employees, of our agents, is that do not start a relationship with this child based on deception.
Right.
And if the child believes that there is deception, put it on yourself. In other words, when you get the child that says, "I can't believe this. My parents said they would never do this," or something, then you go, "Well, you know what? Your parents, whatever it is that they may have told you, are making a decision out of love." And I will ask them, I go, "Are you able to differentiate between you being upset with the deed of what they've done versus being upset with them?" I said, the decision they made was made out of love. So understand that that's love. Now, you can hate the decision, but that's the decision, not the person. But it's still made out of love because they fear that you're going to get into a situation that you aren't able to get yourself out of. And if they then ask me more questions after that, "What do you mean by that?" And I'll tell them, I said, "I had to identify the head of a teenager that washed up on the beach, because the parents were just too distraught to be able to do that." And it's one of the things that I remember so much. I didn't find that child in time. And that's what happened.
That's amazing, the work that you do. I don't think I could be that quite hands-on of identifying a body of a child. That would be very difficult for me. But, in that of finding the runaways, you have escorted thousands of teens to specialized schools and returned them. And in doing that, you retrieved a lot of abducted children in different countries. Can you talk about how you go about finding them in different countries?
Well, and that's usually more on the, it's definitely on the investigation side, but it's more dealing with very small children. If they've been abducted, usually it's a parental abduction. It's where you have a couple that gets divorced here. They oftentimes, if they've run to another country, the parent that runs to that country is originally from that country, and they have a different belief system. And their system might be that no matter what the courts say, the male always gets everything.
Okay.
You know? And so they at times will not honor the American law, and they will wait for an opportunity, like during a visitation. Sometimes it'll be during a weekend. Sometimes it'll be during the summer when they have a week or two at a time. Those are usually the tougher ones because they have a couple weeks head start, mm-hmm. where they are gone and they've already gotten into another country. They've already established something there. But again, as an investigator, that's one of the things that I was trained with. Again, when I first started was working with in situations where somebody has stolen their child, they've gone against the court order, and they've gone to, in some cases, a country that has not signed what's called the Hague Treaty. The Hague Treaty is a law that says that the other countries are going to honor the American law, and if American law enforcement goes over there, they will honor it, and they will allow the child to come back. Well, in most cases, what happens is that law enforcement will contact law enforcement in the other country and say, send them back. We found them. Here's copies of our order. Can you send them back? Unfortunately, there are people who, if they either have enough contacts or connections over in that country, enough money, they can make sure that they've paid the right people that doesn't happen. So now our law enforcement isn't able to do anything, and they have to go private, and that's where they go with a company like ours, because we have contacts there. I'm the past president of the World Association of Detectives, and I can contact local investigators. They can do a lot of the preliminary work, and then we come over with our documentation. Everything is signed by judges. We have what's called a warrant in lieu of writ of habeas corpus. You know, we've covered everything through international law. At that point, we're able to sit down with a judge in that other country, and they will, what we call, perfect our documents that then instructs local law enforcement that they must assist us in getting this child.
And I think that's great work you're doing. I know some of the cases I've worked with through the years have involved people from other countries, and they come up here coming for a new life, but they end up in, like, sex houses, or they become prisoners. And I know you've done a lot of work in human trafficking, and what got you interested in that area of work? Is it with the teens? Is it with adults? Or just part of the natural growth of what you do?
Well, I think for me, getting involved in the human trafficking was dealing with teens. And there was one case when I was very, very young in which I was trying to find a young girl who had run away from home. And I thought that I had found her. And I saw that there was a house and there was a party going on there. And I saw girls going in and out. And I'm watching it with binoculars. And what I thought after a while, as it got later, and I went, oh, it looks like the party's breaking up. I better watch for the girl, because it looks like there's some dads picking up their daughters, and now they're taking them home. And I saw what I thought was the girl I was supposed to find. And I saw she got in with what I thought was the dad. Well, the mom had hired me, and they were divorced. And I thought, well, you know what? This is another one of those situations. Mom told me dad was on board, but it looks like maybe he's not. One of those parents that's sabotaging it or using the child against the other. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, you know, at least I found her, and I can at least tell the mom, don't worry, she's safe. The dad is just, you know, not cooperating. But I went ahead and followed him so I could tell the mom where dad was now. Mm-hmm. And they went to a trailer park. And when I got up close to the trailer park, I realized that this was not, well, first of all, it wasn't her. And it wasn't a dad. And I was able to look in and see that he was having sex with her. And at that point in time, it dawned on me what I had just seen. I had seen a place where men were going and picking up underage girls and taking them away. From that point on, I mean, I really decided that this was something that I needed to do. You know, I had picked up other runaways before. But, they were at their friend's house. They were having some beers. They were staying the night, you know, at their boyfriend or their girlfriend's house. They weren't really in danger. I mean, you know, they were, you know, if it was a rich family, they were four blocks away. it was a different feel. I mean, I still wanted to get them to a program and get them some help, but not like I did for these kids. So anyway, I learned a lot more about it. I got more involved, and my partner in these cases, one of my partners is Logan Clark, and he had been involved in it at a much, much deeper level, where he was being hired by families, not just over the fact that they knew their child had run away, but they knew that their child had been stolen and was involved. And he had traveled to Greece, and he had traveled to the Middle East, he had traveled to Asia. And so we sort of partnered up on this and said, look, I'm dealing with it on a smaller scale in dealing with runaways. He's dealing on a much bigger scale, but together we wanted to see what we could do to stop this. And this is many, many years ago. We went to law enforcement. We went to Hollywood. It wasn't a big deal. The main answer that we got was, isn't that something that happens in another country? They really didn't see it as something that happens in this country. Well, we know now 30 years later, people get it. People know that this is something that happens, and it happens here. And statistically, there is approximately 1.25 million people that are enslaved in the United States alone.
Wow. I mean, that's a lot. I hear a lot from teenage girls, they'll run away, or when I was working with the probation department, they'd be picked up for prostitution and then put in juvenile hall, then eventually coming out. A lot of times they'll go to a program and stay there. A lot of times they run away and go back to their pimp, who usually starts off as a boyfriend,
right,
who's
mm-hmm.
a little bit older, gains their trust, and then they run off with him, and then all of a sudden they're starting to be abused, they're being pimped out to other guys, and a lot of the parents don't know where to turn and how to help their child.
Well, and one of the sad things is, and to any of the kids that are listening, is that some of them, when I've spoken to them afterwards, and I go, why didn't you just leave? And they said, at that point, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed to go back to my family from everything that they had done. And one of the things that I want to tell them is, first of all, there is nothing to be embarrassed about. Your family loves you. And I had dealt with some situations like that. And one of the saddest cases was a girl, this is in another country, and that when I did find her, and I did show her a video of her family saying, we love you, this person has hired us, we've hired this person to find you, and we love you and we want you to come back. And she said, I can't go back. And she showed me a picture of one of her sisters in crosshairs and said, the people that took her said, if you ever take off, we know where your family is. We're going to kill one of your sisters and we're going to take the other one to replace you.
I hear a lot of those threats being done with some of the children and the young teens who are 15 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are pregnant with their second child. And
yep.
It's very disturbing because these are very young children having children being abused, neglected, and thrown out to any man that will pay to have them. And they're having sex for $10. They're having sex for no reason, just to get beaten up. And there's not an escape. How do you think, I know we only have a couple minutes left, but what do you think that parents can do to help stop that whole process from going to that point?
Well, I want to always leave people with kind of a happy ending in the sense of, and in the case that I referred to where I talked about the girl with the picture in crosshairs, we did come back about 3 weeks later. And what we did was we moved the family. And then we had the family do another video and literally show a newspaper and to say, we're okay, we are not where we were before, which means that those people that are saying that they're going to hurt us, they can't. We're in another country now. And we used a T visa and literally moved them to the United States. So, but what I'm saying is, so first of all, I don't want anybody to think, oh my God, it's hopeless. It's not hopeless. We can, we do get them found, and there are happy endings. And at that point, she broke down crying when she realized that it was going to work. In regards to what it is that we can do or what the families can do, I think the main thing is that you need to make sure that your children know that no matter what they get into, that they are loved, that you are not going to judge, that the first and foremost thing is that you are always going to show them that that they are loved, that you will keep them safe. And it can be something like this. It can be anything from the standpoint of, you know, going out and going to a party and not having had the intent to get drunk, but yet you do. You know, pick up the phone, call a parent, and have them come get you. And now parents, you know, understand what it took for them to pick up the phone and not drive. They had to confess the fact that they were drunk. You need to tell them how proud of them you are for doing that. Deal with the drinking thing later.
Much later.
Much
not
later.
Not in the moment.
Not in the moment. Deal with the fact that you love them and that you are going to support them no matter what.
Well, I really wish we had more time here,
Alan. Oh, me too.
It looks like the time's just about up here.
Yeah.
How can people get a hold of your services if they want your help in finding a runaway or your investigative services?
For a phone number, we've got 800-899-8585. And understand, if there is something going on, we will help you in whatever it is. If you're a child out there, let us know. We will help you. If it's a parent, I will help you or refer you to somebody who can. All right? And again, now, Melody, how can they get a hold of you?
I have a website, www.drmelodyfox, that's DrMelodyFoxx, .com. That's not the at word, just .com, drmelodyfox.com. Or if you're locally, it's 949-891-4455 in Newport Beach and Orange County area.
Melody, thank you so much. I know that we're out of time. And for everybody, seek to catch someone doing something good every day.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.